Wow. Talk about mixed messages. Protests are happening all over the place, and people are showing up for all kinds of reasons. What we just heard was a protest of the executive order on immigration. A small group of protesters splintered off and started chanting about police brutality. In case you couldn't quite make out what they were saying, it was, "All cops are killer cops," which inspired another chant. No, they're not. No, they're not. No, they're not. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about the many voices coming together at local protests. Are they making harmony? Dissonance? A little bit of both, perhaps? Call 816-235-2888 to share your experience. If you've been out protesting, where have you been and why? Does it matter whether everyone in the crowd agrees with you? Let's start our conversation with Michael Kazin. He's a Georgetown University historian with expertise in protest and social movements, and he edits Dissent magazine. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of the particular situation we just heard later on, but what generally are you seeing out there protest-wise? Is this moment unique when you look at it in historical context?
Not really. We've had a lot of periods of mass protests in American history, especially when a president is in office who is doing things that a lot of Americans don't like. The Vietnam era protests, of course, are very big, much larger than most of the protests today, with the exception of the Women's March on January 21st, right after President Trump was inaugurated. And this is the American way, you know, when politicians don't like when we don't like what politicians are doing, or a large proportion of people don't like what politicians are doing, we get out in the streets and we yell about it. And sometimes that has an important impact and changes policy, even can topple a president, as arguably it toppled Lyndon Johnson back in 1968. And sometimes it dissipates and doesn't have that much impact.
Well, it sounds like that people protest isn't new, but is there anything about the way that people are or maybe are not coming together, is that new?
Well, of course, they're using social media. The Women's March on last January 21st was initiated very quickly in less than a month by a group of women in Hawaii, I believe, who most people involved in activism elsewhere in the country had not heard about before. That's unusual. Back in the 1960s, you had big mobilization committees who worked for months and months to put these things together. But also you're seeing that a lot of people who don't like President Trump and his policies and the policies of the Republican-controlled Congress have their own reasons for not liking them, as opposed to, say, a civil rights march or an anti-war march back in the 60s or the demonstrations which opposed President George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. People have lots of different reasons why they don't like President Trump. And so it's hard to say that there is one focus for the protest besides we don't like this new president or anything he's doing.
You know, I wonder if the effectiveness of a protest is in any way diminished by people being there for different and maybe even conflicting reasons, because on the other side of that, maybe you could say there's strength in numbers regardless.
I think that's true. I mean, the weakness, of course, is that if President Trump does something which is very popular, as perhaps this new healthcare law that just was unveiled yesterday by the House Republicans will be. I don't know whether it will be or not. That's a different discussion. But that could diminish, for example, the passion of some of the people turning out at Senator Roberts' office, for example, or his meetings and the town halls of other Republican senators and congresspeople, because a lot of that passion was about replacing the ACA, replacing Obamacare. So what you might call a popular front of protest, which is what we see today, could be less of a popular front if some of President Trump's policies prove to be more popular.
Well, we'll get back to this conversation shortly. But for now, let's hear from someone who has built a broad coalition across party lines that others are actually trying to emulate. Patty Logan started Stand Up Blue Valley. That's a group that formed in response to budget cuts affecting the Blue Valley School District. Patty, why don't you tell the story? Take me back to the moment that spurred you into action.
Well, thanks for having me. I can't take credit, of course, for Stand Up Blue Valley. I'm one of a six-member steering committee that started actually in April of 2015. We came together as a result of our Blue Valley School Board election. We became aware that a person who we felt was anti-public education was running for the school board in Blue Valley, which didn't make any sense at all. And as we became aware, kind of as individuals, that this was going on, we started coming together to support the very pro-public education.
When you say coming together, that's a phrase people use a lot, but it makes it sound like you're magnets that just sort of plopped into a clump or something. It can't be that way.
You know, through Facebook, in a way, it kind of was, because we were using Facebook at that time as individuals. We were commenting on the Facebook page of the anti-public education candidate. We were commenting on our own Facebook pages about the pro-public education candidate, and we began to see each other's names over and over. We were replying to each other's posts. And so even though each of us only knew maybe one of the other of us, we didn't know, all six of us didn't know each other by any means. We started knowing each other just by name and by reputation as a pro-public education person on Facebook. And then after that election happened and the pro-public education candidate won by a landslide, we actually went out that night for beers together and we saw each other for the first time.
That was the first time after your movement sort of at least appears to have been had a positive effect, at least positive as far as your position went, you know. That's the first time you saw each other face to face?
Yes. I knew one other person who's involved, and two other people knew each other through Girl Scouts, and two other people knew each other through school, not close, but just knew each other. And yeah, we all saw each other for the first time the night of that election.
So what happened then? I mean, first of all, you shared a view on a particular candidate for a particular local office, just district-wide, but did you guys share other views really broadly, or did you represent a lot of different, political and ideological viewpoints?
Kind of both. We realized that night, we started talking, and we realized that a person running for our school board who was not pro-public education was a symptom of a big problem that we felt was facing our school district and facing public education. And so we just started talking, and it turns out we're all kind of nerds. And so we all started talking together about things like, you know, anti-tax, anti-public education legislation that had been kind of snowballing and was behind this movement of anti-public education. And then we ended up just deciding to get together. And when it started, there were more than just the six steering committee members. We had several people joining us and weighing in. And then as we decided to really decide to form an organization and make certain goals, then we kind of narrowed down to the six people who really had the time to do that and really felt like that was something they wanted to commit to.
My understanding of Stand Up Blue Valley is that it is not affiliated with any party.
That's correct. We're very much bipartisan. When we started Stand Up Blue Valley, some of our steering committee members had been lifelong Republicans, identified as Republicans, and were disappointed in the way that the Republican Party had gone in terms of extremism and anti-tax above responsible government and above funding things that people hold dear in Johnson County, Kansas, and Blue Valley, which is where we all are. And some of our members were lifelong Democrats and had been very opposed to ever voting for a Republican and were registered Democrats. And so we really came from all sides of the political spectrum.
Even a side that overall kind of supports the current governor of Kansas and his initiatives, even while disagreeing with this on this one issue?
No. Our Republican members consider themselves moderate Republicans. They consider themselves fiscally responsible. They would never support running a budget into the ground. They would never support cutting taxes to the point of irresponsible taxation.
So it's your coalition is maybe more bipartisan than all of the political spectrum.
Yes, I would agree with that. I don't think that we have extreme liberals on either side.
So what?
I mean, sorry, extremists on either side.
As you built this more formal organization, what surprised you as maybe a newcomer to politics outside of voicing opinions on Facebook?
Well, I don't know that we were really surprised. We talked and talked and talked. We do a lot of talking. And so we talked about a lot of things that might happen, a lot of things that we could see that we could influence and maybe that we couldn't influence. And so we did a lot of talking before we ever really took a lot of action. So I don't know that a lot of things surprised us because one or the other of us had said, what if this or what if that? But I guess we were a little bit surprised that the legislators who had been elected to represent our area by Blue Valley voters were unwilling to listen to us. They would not return our emails. They would not return phone calls. We asked them to participate in forums to educate voters. They refused to do so. So I guess we were a little bit surprised at just maybe, I would say, the level of even animosity that currently seated legislators had for Blue Valley voters.
What do you think are the limits of inclusion across different ideologies? I mean, it sounds like for your group that limit is a position on taxes, perhaps.
Well, we're very narrowly focused on education. And of course, taxes and education are very intertwined because of the funding issue. So I guess I'm not exactly sure I understand your question, but we are really focused only on education. And we made a very conscious decision from the beginning that there are Blue Valley voters who value public education by far the majority of Blue Valley voters. And there are some of those that are on what we would consider an extreme on other positions. And so we just don't engage in those other positions at all. That's not our business. We're just about education.
What do you think? I mean, do you think it matters to have people representing a lot of different viewpoints, as many as possible in a group? Or do you think it matters more to be really narrowly focused and clear about this is what we stand for, this is what we're going for, be a part of this movement if you agree with that, period?
Well, I think we have definitely reached out to people who have had other viewpoints, more of the education has enough funding or maybe even has too much funding. We've reached out to those people, both legislators and voters, and we've found common ground because everybody agrees that public schools are the driver, the economic driver in Johnson County and in Blue Valley. And so we found common ground in support of our schools. How we do that in terms of funding and other things, maybe there has been some difference in people who have bought into our big message, I guess.
Michael, what do you hear in Patty's story?
Well, it's a wonderful story, and she tells it very well. I think education is, you know, one of those issues that is much more important to people, perhaps, than some people in Washington understand sometimes, not just in Kansas, but obviously there was a huge protest movement against Betsy DeVos's nomination to be education secretary because she was perceived as a figure who was hostile to public education, who only wanted private charter schools and religious schools, thought they were much better for students than public schools. And really, as you know, she won confirmation by just the vice president's vote.
Very thin margin.
And I think, you know, what Stand Up Blue Valley is a great example of is the kind of grassroots organizing, the kind of local organizing that really is the core of a democracy, I think. The way in which people don't just watch television or go on Twitter and vent their unhappiness. They organize, they go to meetings. First, they meet each other sometimes on social media, as seems to be true with this organization. But then they have to meet face-to-face. Then they have to go to meetings. Then they have to study things. It's a matter of political education and political mobilization at the same time. And
I have a question for you, though, Michael. I mean, in the case of Betsy DeVos's nomination and confirmation hearings, they were really controversial. And they were controversial among both Democrats and Republicans. In fact, you know, the Republicans who voted against her were from largely rural states where people in rural areas, their constituents had let them know that they didn't back that because of some issues very particular to rural education. And I'm, as far as what people show up for protest-wise and what they don't, it's surprising that something with that kind of bipartisan energy behind it, like, where was the rural education protest?
That's a good point. And of course, only two Republican senators voted against her. So it wasn't a huge uprising by Republicans. But, well, look, I mean, protests also about not just about what issue people care about in public opinion polls. They're about how you mobilize, and you mobilize through institutions. There are teachers unions, two very big ones, the NEA and the FT, which are very much opposed to her for, you know, self-interested reasons and also because they care about education. And there are various foundations which are very involved in education. So obviously groups like that are not as well mobilized in rural areas. People in rural areas, for the most part, are organized, I think, with their neighbors, through very local institutions, but they're not always as well connected to the larger institutions, which really generate protest and mass marches and lobbying in Congress and state legislatures.
But you don't think that, just sort of more broadly, what issues people aren't showing up for right now, protest-wise? Like, what do you think is the significance of what doesn't inspire a protest?
Well, it shows two things. It shows, one, that people don't think it's so important, obviously, and two, that even those who think it's important don't know how to mobilize attention behind it. I'm trying to think of an issue. I mean, there's so many people who are unhappy about different aspects of what President Trump is talking about and wants to do. I'm trying to think of an issue that really is not mobilization.
Yeah, depending on your opinion, maybe this isn't separate from him. People see this differently. But what about, like, right now there's a lot of talk about threats on synagogues and acts in Jewish cemeteries. I haven't heard about the march against anti-Semitism.
No, but there are a lot of people who are talking about it. There have been mosques in areas that where Jewish cemeteries have been desecrated, who've been pitching in money to help put those cemeteries back together again, for example. There's been coverage about that. And certainly Jewish groups, as you might expect, the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League has denounced it in no uncertain terms. And that's part of the reason why President Trump, after some delay, did feel he had to speak out against it in the first sentence of his speech to Congress last week. So that shows, I think, a mobilization which doesn't show up in the streets necessarily, but is nevertheless quite effective.
Well, historian Michael Kazin's going to stay here through the break. When we come back, we'll hear voices from actual protests in our area. Patty Logan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. Back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Georgetown University's Michael Kazin. He's also the editor of Dissent magazine. Today's topic, protest in 2017. Who's showing up where and why? And does it matter if everyone in the crowd doesn't answer that question the same way? Let's hear some examples, starting with the protest at the airport after the executive order on immigration was issued, blocking the entry of refugees from majority Muslim countries. The organizer of the protest was Jacob Mengano. He told our producer that he'd cast kind of a wide net.
I would like to say that I scheduled a conference room and everybody invited themselves to the conversation. So, yeah.
During that protest, a small group broke off to march inside. Most were wearing red bandanas over their faces, and they wouldn't talk to our producer to confirm or deny their identity or their message. They chanted, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." They ended up in a standoff with airport police for about 20 minutes. This is what Desmond Daniels, who was there, had to say about it.
You want my honest opinion? I think they're just looking for some glory right now.
The people on the front line?
Yeah, the people, because there's no detainees here. And by there not being any detainees here, then what's your purpose? If it's a detainee here, then yeah, I'm all for it. You know, get them out, let's do what we got to do. But there's no detainees here right now. I think you should be outside and try to keep the environment lively, build with people, know how to network with people, know how to talk. You know, you have to be a real organizer, a real protester. It's about building, not destroying.
But Lauren Anderson disagrees.
Inside there, we were basically protesting against militarized police. Police are usually targeting black and brown bodies. And you can see that across the U.S., in which we had Trayvon Martin, which we had other black and brown individuals getting killed for no reason. Just even with your hands up, you get shot. And so we were protesting what is not right, what's unfair, and what happens to mostly brown and black bodies. They may be organized group, but I'm just by myself. So. I think for me, why I came out is why most people come out, because we see that our president is allowing for racist, for unconstitutional policies to be enforced, and that's not okay.
Michael Kazin, is this scenario like a healthy, normal part of grassroots protest, or is this an example of things falling apart?
Well, you could argue it's both. I mean, it's always been true since I, in the protests I've studied going back over 100 years, that there are people who want to protest peaceably, who want to be respectful and respectable, and the people who want to disrupt, people who want to show that what's going on in the country is not good, not normal, and they want to sort of grab people by the collar and say, do you understand how terrible things are? Because if you aren't grabbing people by the collar, metaphorically, they believe, then people aren't paying attention. They want people to pay attention to what they're doing. So,
is this all about peaceful versus more disruptive kinds of protest, or is it partly about race?
Well, it's partly about race, but obviously there have been very peaceful marches and demonstrations more recently, and also going back many years by African-American activists, the Great 63 Civil Rights March, for example, mostly black African-American activists there, a 250,000 people altogether, very peaceful. There was always, of course, as we know, race is a crucial dividing point in America and in American history, and violence has been a very important part of racism going back to slavery. So it's not surprising that people who are protesting against racist violence as they see it sometimes get disruptive and want to, again, show that they're not going to turn the other cheek, they're not going to be peaceful when they see injustice. Whether or not that's effective or not is a different question. But
what's the answer to that one?
Well, personally, I mean, this is my own point of view. I think it's better to be peaceful, better to do what Martin Luther King Jr. did, which to show that the other side is violent. As you know, one of the things that King did in the Birmingham demonstration, 1963, for example, famously, was he had school children march in the streets of Birmingham, knowing that the police, the racist police force of Birmingham, was going to sick police dogs on them, was going to hit them with high-pressure water hoses, was going to beat them up with nightsticks. He knew that was going to happen, but he thought, and quite correctly, I think, in retrospect, that this would show how much violence was behind Jim Crow, how much violence was behind segregation. And this worked for the civil rights movement at the time. But of course, a lot of people like Malcolm X said, you are getting black people beat up and even killed, and you're telling them don't fight back. And so obviously that was not a popular strategy for some people in the black movement.
Tell me about results of less peaceful protest. Are they different historically?
Well, you know, it depends which ones you're talking about. I mean, certainly the riots of the late 1960s in the cities probably helped to get anti-poverty programs passed and helped to have more surveillance is the wrong word, and more attention to police brutality, because a lot of them started with police brutality. At the same time, they also helped to generate calls for law and order, helped to generate the rise of conservative movement, which in many ways was hostile to at least parts of the civil rights agenda. So I think in the long run, my own view about this, I think it's true of most historians, is that violent protests are usually counterproductive.
Let's move on to the Women's March and the Abortion Rights March that followed. For this part of our discussion, I'd like to bring in another guest. Sarah McCammon is with us from NPR. She's a Kansas City native. Got to get that in there. And she covered the Trump campaign. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Yes, you definitely have to get that in there.
The Kansas City.
Hello, Kansas City. Yes.
Well, Sarah, I want first of all, to get some of your response to what you've heard, because you've covered Trump's supporters, and we've heard a lot so far about people who oppose Trump. And I'd like to hear from you about, you know, it's not just people who are against Trump who are out showing what they stand for right now.
Right. I mean, a lot of it is, and that might be to be expected, given, you know, I think a lot of people said going into the election that whoever won, there were going to be a lot of unhappy people on one side or the other, and Trump won. And so, you know, perhaps not surprisingly, most of the opposition comes from people who aren't happy about that. Had there been another outcome, we might well see the same thing in reverse. There have been, just over the weekend, there were a series of protests around the country in support of Trump, or marches in support of Trump, which, from what I gathered, were, I think, organized kind of in response to some of the protests we've been seeing. You know, anecdotally, I wasn't at any of those, but just from reading some reports, I didn't get the sense that there was a huge groundswell. But certainly, you know, there was a huge surprising result on November 8th, surprising in many people's minds. And many of Trump's supporters seem to still be very much with him. And many of those who did not vote for him are still very much concerned about some of the things he's doing and has promised to do.
Let's hear from a woman named Talia. Our producer met her at the Women's March in Kansas City. She's a conservative Christian, has been all her life. And this recent election was the first time she didn't vote Republican. She was there alone at the march, saying that a lot of women in her community would have felt unchristian being there, particularly because of the abortion issue. But Talia saw her own participation as she put it, an expression of Christ's love, a stand against hatred, oppression, ridicule. That's why she held a sign that said, "Love conquers fear." She said that her husband didn't agree with her decision to march, but he still gave her a ride.
It's powerful to be here, even if I'm standing alone. I'm glad that he drove me. It means he cares enough. He wants me to have a voice, even if it's slightly different than his. Even if my voice is slightly different from the hundreds of other voices that are here.
Sarah, talk to me about, you hear so much isolation in her voice, even being part of this crowd. I mean, she feels clearly empowered, but also alone. Talk about the role of conservative women in that National Women's March, which you could say was a national women's movement.
Right. Well, it actually, that was a really interesting clip of tape, because it kind of reminded me of some of the conservative women I talked to, you know, throughout last year, who were many of whom were wrestling with Trump as the GOP nominee. I did a story about evangelical Christian women, including some leading voices in the evangelical movement, who were really upset when the Access Hollywood tapes came out in October, the famous tapes that we've all heard, where Trump describes, you know, women's genitalia in obscene terms. Those kinds of things were very distressing to a lot of conservative Christians, especially women who, you know, many of whom oppose abortion rights, who maybe oppose same-sex marriage, and yet, you know, were very concerned about some of the ways that their nominee and now the president have talked about women. At the same time, I think it's important to point out that 53% of white women, and, you know, when we talk about evangelicals, we're often talking about white evangelicals, because evangelicals of color tend to have different political views. So 53% of white women did vote for Trump. So he ultimately won that demographic by a little bit. And he won evangelicals by more than 80%. So I'm sure this woman does feel isolated. You know, if those kinds of numbers are any indication of what actually happened, if those exit polls are any indication, she is, you know, in kind of an unusual spot. But as far as the Women's March goes, there was some controversy. There were a few controversies surrounding it. First of all, about inclusion of women of color, whether or not their voices and concerns were being heard enough by the national leadership. And also about, you know, where more conservative women fall. There were a couple of anti-abortion groups, including a group that described themselves as pro-life feminists, who wanted to be part of the march, wanted to be co-sponsors, and were told they couldn't be co-sponsors because the platform of the organization was pro-abortion rights. Some of those groups still came and marched. I mean, they were allowed to participate, but not to be sort of official sponsors. Others stayed home. But, you know, I heard some real angst from more conservative women about, you know, saying, look, I agree that women should be paid equally to men. I agree that family planning should be available. I agree that women should have an option to have maternity leave, or, you know, that should be more widely available for moms, and all sorts of things that they may share with the Women's March. But there were some differences on some really key issues. So, you know, I think that protest, even though it was painted as a moment of unity among women, you know, was with any large group, there is division about other issues.
Well, that brings up a question that I asked Michael. I mean, to what extent do you think, you know, on the one hand, if you are very inclusive, there's likely to be, I mean, it seems like on one side you could have total inclusiveness, which is often also kind of a lack of clarity of the goals of a protest or who is protesting what. And then on the other side, maybe less inclusion and more clarity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see it with any time you get a group of people in a room who agree on something, they're going to disagree on others. And I mean, you certainly see it in churches. That's the first thing I think of. You know, I've known of so many churches that start out as, you know, a large church, and then they split over this or that issue. That's sort of like the history of Protestant Christianity.
It's the history of religion.
It's the history of religion, really. Yes, it is. I mean, you know, you see it in politics too. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a philosopher, but, or a psychologist, so I can't really tell you why. But, you know, we even saw it in the Gavin Grimm Supreme Court case that was going to go before the Supreme Court. This was the transgender young man from Virginia who was basically suing for the right to use the bathroom that matched his gender identity. And in that case, there was an amicus brief filed by a radical feminist group that was questioning whether or not transgender women should be considered women, you know, by the same standards as, you know, women who are born biologically female. That I just cite as an example of, you know, even feminism tends to be very pro-trans rights, but there are divisions within feminism about issues like, you know, how to deal with the question of transgender rights and even abortion. So it is fascinating. You saw that with the Women's March, and it'll be interesting, I think, to see going forward with some of these other movements that are springing up,
yeah,
and pushing back against Donald Trump. You know, what do they prioritize? What,
yeah,
do they agree on? What do they disagree on? Can they stay cohesive?
Well, let's pick up on that abortion question. In response to the Women's March in Kansas City, there was a March for Life. One of the speakers was Jack Cashel, an anti-abortion proponent who's pretty well known here in town. Let's hear what he told the crowd.
It was the march or whatever, the rally last week of women here and in Washington. Thanks to them, there are many more cameras here today than there otherwise would have been.
Amen. That's right. Amen.
So, Sarah, you know, I'm interested in this idea. I mean, do you think that this is... talk to me about the role of the media in this cycle of movement and anti-movement, protest and anti-protest. You know what I mean? Have we, the media, inadvertently turned this into a contest of who gets more coverage, who gets more cameras?
It can be that. I think it's really important. I mean, first of all, I can really just speak to how I and NPR covers events when it comes to that sort of question. We're very careful about estimating crowd numbers, for one thing, because really, we're not in a position to do that. We don't have helicopters. We don't have special training in crowd estimation. So we tend to either, you know, stick to officially provided numbers by law enforcement or, you know, public agencies if they're provided. And even sometimes that can be fraught, you know, if you're talking about a protest against police, you know. So you have to sort of take even that with a grain of salt sometimes. But, you know, in general, we stay away from that. And really with the Women's March and then the March for Life, which followed in D.C., I covered both of those events. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, who had the bigger crowd, who had the bigger turnout, which is all well and good. But, you know, those aren't the same event. The Women's March was a, you know, a large sort of semi-spontaneously kind of, you know, one-time activity organized sort of leading up to and in response to the election. The March for Life is something that's been happening for decades every single year. So, you know, you can get into false equivalency. You have to put things in context. Numbers don't always tell the whole story. But, you know, sometimes two protests are there for, they're there for the cameras. I mean, you know, I've certainly, especially when I was younger, you know, you get a press release, there's going to be an anti-war march or something, you know, during the height of the Iraq war. You know, a lot of times those things are, you know, they want people to come, but they want the media to know. And then you also see sort of more spontaneous protests where people just sort of come into the street and respond. And it seems that their protest is more targeted at the government. And of course, you can't talk about protest movements without talking about social media. So whether or not the TV cameras are there, people are there with their cameras and their cell phones and tweeting and taking pictures. And sometimes that sort of feeds the cycle and more people come. So yeah, I mean, I think protests are meant to have a witness. That's why people do them. And we're all part of that now.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns to this conversation about protests, we'll get to your calls. What are the causes that inspire you to show up? Are there issues you care about that aren't mobilizing people? What's the difference? And is it good or bad to have lots of different viewpoints and lots of different voices? Your take on KCUR's Central Standard after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about protest, specifically whether everyone at a protest needs to agree about everything they're protesting. You can call 816-235-2888 if you have experience that gives you insight into that. We're with NPR's Sarah McCammon and Georgetown University and Dissent Magazine's Michael Kazin. I want to ask both of you, Sarah, you were just saying that having witnesses is an important part of protest, but who is the audience of a protest? We recently did some reporting on some response from GOP elected officials in Kansas to the protests at the State House in Topeka. You know, they seem to feel that the protesters are bullying them, are trying to stop them from enacting the will of the people who put them in office. That seems like if the elected officials, if people in power are the audience, it seems like that's falling on deaf ears. Sarah?
Well, I mean, I guess what I would say about that is that, you know, protest, peaceful protest is a long tradition in this country. It's one of the ways that the citizenry can get the attention of our elected officials who work for us. So while I can understand that it would be tempting for, you know, for elected officials who are getting a lot of pushback to say that, I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, I mean, our right to peacefully assemble and speak freely is enshrined in our Constitution for a reason. Our founders knew that that would be an important way to keep the government in check. That being said, you know, some of the town halls specifically, you know, it's been difficult for, you know, there's been a lot of vocal opposition. I haven't seen any reports of violence. If I've missed them, I apologize. So, you know, I mean, what's the exact best way to do a protest? I don't have an opinion on that. But I think it's pretty clear that, you know, for throughout our country's history, protest, and certainly if you think back to the civil rights movement, it's been an important way that people who feel they are marginalized, who feel their voices aren't being heard, make sure that they are heard by their leaders.
Sarah, talk to me quickly about the Tea Party. I mean, do you see any crossover with the style of protest we're seeing from the left now in comparison with the Tea Party's response to Obama's election? Or is this a different animal entirely?
Oh, there's definitely crossover. In fact, by design, I did a story a little while back about a group called Indivisible, which is just one of several organizations that are organizing town hall protests and other forms of activism, including, you know, reaching out to members of Congress and senators and showing up in their offices and a whole host of different things. But Indivisible is quite explicitly modeled after the Tea Party, where you saw the same thing after President Obama was elected. And many people on the right were concerned about that, distressed about his policies, wanted to make sure that their lawmakers knew how they felt. And so they began, you know, organizing locally in their communities, having meetings with really their friends and neighbors, and mobilizing grassroots activism, taking over town halls in many cases, and making sure that their representatives in Congress knew how they felt. Indivisible is following that playbook quite directly. They have a guide online that was written by former congressional staffers who know what does and doesn't work to get the attention of members of Congress. And they said basically the Tea Party did a good job of, you know, getting those elected officials to pay attention, getting their attention, in many cases organizing locally and, you know, winning some local and statewide races. And just pushing, you know, particular policy points of view, trying to sort of slow down the Obama administration agenda. And that is really what Indivisible wants to do in reverse.
Let's talk to Leslie in Overland Park, who's answering our question about whether it matters that protesters are all kind of on the same page. Leslie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hey, it's a really interesting topic, and I started writing down how many marches and protests and walks I've been to, and I had to laugh because it's really a lot. You know, I'm going to be going to the Science March, March for Bernie twice. I went to Philly, March Against Monsanto. But I wanted to talk about the Women's March. I really hesitated going for a long time until that day, until I heard that some friends were going. I didn't want to be seen as going because I wanted Hillary to win, you know, and that's the main reason why I was going. So I hesitated. I never found my friends. I dropped my Bernie T-shirt that I brought. The whole thing was just kind of.
Wait a minute. Wait, you dropped you dropped your Bernie T-shirt that you brought? Explain.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, and so that I had brought it to give to a friend. So the whole experience was just one of walking around thinking, this was great, but where were you guys last summer? You know, a lot of them might have protested for Bernie to be the nominee. But so it was just kind of an odd experience for me because I wasn't sure where I would fit in.
Yeah, so, maybe. And I mean, the difference there between being protesting an elected official against an elected official or for a candidate who didn't win or as part of a gender, there were some confusing things.
Yeah. And there are a lot of issues within that whole thing. So And then the other experience, I went to KCI, and I went with a friend who's really, really amiable, and she doesn't like conflict at all, and I don't really all that much. But I was approached by the group with the red bandanas, and honestly, I was tempted to go along with them for a for a minute. And there was a woman who tattled on them, and so there's that approach. And then there was another woman who just really was arguing against them even being there. I guess I just felt like, even though I really see the validity of protesting against police brutality, and I've got some Black Lives Matter friends, I felt like the tipping point wasn't right there in front of me because the police were really supportive and smiling generally. And so I really wasn't quite sure what to do there, but I knew I felt like I wanted to be there. So sometimes you don't know why you go to a march.
Well, thanks, Leslie. That is an interesting perspective that sometimes you feel like you belong somewhere and you're still in the process of figuring out where you belong and why, even after you arrive. Michael Kazin, jump in here. I mean, this conversation has progressed a little bit since last time we heard from you. Are you hearing anything new that you want to draw our attention to?
Well, I think the last caller's comment, I think, is interesting, and some of the things Sarah said dovetail with this. You know, really, in protest politics, there's often a tension between sort of the desire of individuals in the protest to express themselves, to say exactly what's on their mind, to be authentic, to not do something phony. A tension between that and what you might argue are the strategic needs of the protest. You know, what is the protest going to accomplish? Indivisible the group more or less affiliated with Democrats, obviously, which Sarah mentioned. Clearly, they are trying to get people to do things very strategically, to not commit violence, obviously, to try to raise certain arguments, to have certain slogans even, which they raise at these town meetings. That's not the same as someone like the caller, who clearly is following her own drummer, so to speak, is trying to understand both how this protest connects with a candidate who she wishes had been nominated and elected, who wasn't nominated and elected. You know, she wants to be true to her political feelings and her emotions about this moment today. And, you know, everyone can't express themselves in an authentic way in every protest. If they did, there'd be, you know, 3 million different individual protests taking place at any given moment. On the other hand, protests also have to give people the opportunity to make their own protest signs, to chant their own slogans, to sing their own songs, to have a diversity of speakers. So there's always a tension there, I think, and never more than now, because after all, you know, you turn on your computer every day and you can go to Twitter and involve yourself in protest, or in Facebook, involve yourself in protest. It's a lot easier than it used to be.
Sarah, from your perspective, I mean, having covered Trump rallies and Tea Party protests, I'm curious about whether that same tension exists there.
Within the Tea Party or?
Yeah, within the Tea Party and even more generally on the right, because we've heard from Leslie that there is this, and confirmed by Michael, that there is this tension on the left. But is there that same sense of if everyone there had an authentic message, it would be, you know, for every 100 people, 100 messages?
I mean, I think you have, you know, different people disagree about what to prioritize, certainly. And I mean, that's kind of why we have in parties, we have primaries, right? Because you might have 17 candidates who all, you know, on major issues have very similar platforms. And yet it's a question of style and tone and you know, what issues take center stage. I mean, I covered the Republican primary, and this isn't a protest, but I mean, just to talk about sort of nuance and division within organizations like political parties, you know, you saw sort of two or three candidates that people whose primary concern was, you know, maybe social issues would line up behind. And then there were other candidates that, you know, those who were more concerned about fiscal issues would line up behind. And then, you know, there were a couple of outsiders one of whom, of course, won, you know, who attracted people who just felt like the whole system was a mess. And so, yeah, I mean, while on paper you might have the same sort of general policy platform, there's the question of what gets the most attention and, you know, what sort of takes up the most oxygen. You see this at conventions, too, you know, party conventions. There's always a discussion about what should go in the platform and what should be changed. And so, yeah, I don't think it's unique to the left.
Do you think that religion plays a bigger role in uniting people in a cause these days, or I don't know, creating maybe difference within people who generally might otherwise agree with each other? Can you talk to me about religion and movement building in America? Just a small topic.
Yeah, it's interesting just because, you know, yeah, just a small question. I mean, obviously, I've covered evangelicals a lot, and they have a long history of mobilizing behind certain issues, especially things like same-sex marriage and abortion. I think you're seeing more and more, though, that there are other voices. I mean, just about any time President Trump issues an executive order or makes a statement, especially on issues like immigration, I see more sort of left-leaning Christian and other religious organizations coming out and saying, no, you know, we disagree. I think there is a desire among some, you know, religious people on the left to articulate their point of view from a religious perspective and a recognition of the fact that the right has done that really well. And sometimes the left is a little more hesitant to. It certainly is an effective technique. Religion is something that motivates people really strongly, and it can motivate their politics, too.
Michael, parting thoughts on that issue?
We're a very religious country, but we don't agree about religion. So, of course, religious groups are going to disagree. There's a great movement called Moral Mondays in North Carolina, which is a religious left movement led by a black preacher who's also head of the NAACP in that state. So in some ways, religious left is finding its voice, in part because Donald Trump is seen by a lot of people, even conservative evangelicals, as Sarah mentioned, as, let us say, not much of a Christian.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Kazin, thank you so much. Great hearing from your perspective.
Thanks. Go Royals.
And Sarah McCammon, thanks for joining us from NPR today.
Yeah, thanks. And go Royals for sure.
Thanks to everyone who called as well. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, development on Kansas City's east side. Can something be done to encourage people to invest more money there? Tomorrow at 10, KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman.